Hello, and welcome to Life Lab. I'm David Ponder.
And I'm Zach Schaefer.
We created a candid podcast for busy people. We get right to the point of our topics, and we keep them to 30 minutes or less.
We wanted to put our ideas out there, share it with people we love, and if it spreads, great.
Our show has no edits and no gimmicks.
Like it or don't, we initially started this project for ourselves, to record our thoughts for our kids, but our friends and family thought we should share it, so here you go. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Life Lab. I'm Zach Schaefer.
And I'm David Ponder.
And we are talking about money again for the second time. And who knows, maybe we'll have a third time.
It's a big one.
But we wanted to start it off with a story, and I'm going to share this with you. One of my current mentors, colleagues, great friends, and also business partner, Bob Krizik, who goes also by Dr. K to his students. He shared some insights recently with one of my graduate classes. It was called Communication Consulting, and so I had him come in because he's an organizational consultant and has done a variety of things over the last 30 years. And in talking with him, one of my students said, you know, what is one of the key things that has helped you out as a consultant throughout your consulting career? And he paused, and he's a very thoughtful thinker. And he said, the fact that I have never had to rely on a single revenue stream because I was always financially independent. And the students didn't even know, because it didn't have anything to do with consulting.
Right.
But it was so interesting to hear him say that. Fast forward 1 month after that, I am in Scotland on the island of Islay for a great Scotch festival with Bob. We were over there doing some research and development for our company, Distilled Expertise. And, of course, we were already great friends. We've almost known each other 20 years, but we really got to dive in and learn about each other's lives, fears, goals, etc. And so I just probed him on that response because I found it so interesting, and it came out of left field. And one of the things he had always taught me was with any really all of his students, with any decision, you always need to ask yourself, what do you get and what do you give up? And 3 minutes ago, right before we started this, I just realized that he was giving a lesson in economics. He's talking about what are your opportunity costs, and he just didn't call it that, but that's exactly what it's about. So for what I took away from Bob's story, and he shared this very candidly, is he stumbled into financial success with a group of friends in the late 60s and 70s, started a dive bar outside of Chicago, and just crushed it from day one, parlayed that into seven different bars and restaurants throughout the Chicago area, did very well. From that, he was able to, of course, work hard at that business the entire time. He's pretty conservative financially, so he saved and set smart goals, and then sold out to his partners because he wanted to start a different career. But the point that I took away and that he made is that his career as an academic and as a consultant would not have gone the way it had he not had that financial independence.
Right.
And so it just blows my mind that when asked, what makes you a great consultant? The fact that I didn't have to worry about anything because I was financially set. It was just such an eye-opening answer, especially from someone who's an academic.
And that goes against, you're supporting the argument that I gave in part one about giving money to your kids,
He has no kids.
But I know, but if my kids were just financially independent and you said, what made you a great consultant? The fact that I was financially independent.
And you're
from
making
the start,
a huge assumption that they would take that money and do the right thing with it.
I'm not saying that they would, but he did.
So he earned his money.
Right.
It wasn't given to him. That's huge difference.
That's a very good point.
It's a huge difference.
Okay. Very good point. Very good point.
He earned his money. He worked hard. He set goals and he achieved them. So again, one thing I want the audience today is I show you why Dave's wrong in the way he approaches money is you've got to earn what you get in this world. And even if daddy and mommy give it to you, you're not going to appreciate it because it wasn't yours. You didn't create it. You didn't build it. So I want you, while we talk through this, and Dave's going to bring out some really smart, big, high-level economic ideas later, ask yourself and be honest, do you think like an owner or do you think like an employee?
Okay, great, great start, great story. I love it. we're talking, when we're talking about this, we are saying it in the context of parents and children. Think of it also in the context of authority figures, power figures, and, you know, subordinates, or I don't even know what you would want to call it. You could say government and citizens. You could say whatever, right? Because I'll bring up the idea of a universal basic income later. And if you parallel what you're saying with your kids deserve no money. They should have to earn everything on their own. It's like a super right-wing conservative viewpoint of economics in our country. So let's talk about, I want to give a reaction to that. I am actually a little bit on the left when it comes to that, because if you look at, let's talk about it. If we're going to draw that parallel between countries, governments, and people, and parents and children, then let's look at what are the more successful countries. The purely capitalistic countries that give zero welfare, zero safety net, zero social security, a lot of those are in Central America, Brazil, which I experienced myself, and they have almost across the board terrible education systems, rampant homelessness, high crime, shanty towns where people are living. And then on the flip side, governments that actually take care of their people very well through high taxes and high social safety nets are Norway, Switzerland, Sweden, and almost across the board again, best education systems in the world, lowest crime in the world, and so on and so forth. Now, so to say, well, you can't draw that parallel and say, just because a country does that, that parents and children, there's going to be any kind of thing like there's going to be any correlation or even causation. And I'll agree with you. But I just want to throw that idea out there because I think it's an interesting parallel. And the other thing I'd like to say is we're talking about motivation. So Zach said the difference between Dr. Krizek having the money and a parent giving the kid the money is that he earned it. And I agree with you. That builds on something that we talked about last part one, which was how do you allow someone to build their life and build a foundation, a financial understanding and intelligence and foundation, you know, like if I'm going to give my kids money, how do I let them do that so that they understand the value of money and hard work and earning it prior to giving it to them? That's the challenge that I see, because that's what you're saying. Dr. Krizek already had that by the time that he became financially independent versus just being a spoiled brat who never had to learn that and getting the money. I don't think that you or I would argue that what he said is true. Being financially independent allows you freedom to pursue just about anything that you want and do it more effectively. Where we're arguing is, how do you get someone to have that foundation, that financial intelligence and financial foundation?
I mean, let me clarify. If somehow I earn, or if I start playing the lottery and hit the lottery and have $10 million, obviously, my children are going to get something. They're going to have a lifestyle where they're secure, but they're not just going to get some enormous trust fund and say, here you go. I just don't find that that leads to a productive lifestyle. But I didn't come from those families or that type of socioeconomic background. It's just an odd thing to me. So right. It's easy for me to stand outside of their system and critique it because I don't know all the nuances of it.
Well, and to be clear, nor did I. It's not like I'm getting any kind of trust fund either. It's just that I've laid out the ideas that I've connected to come to my conclusion as well. And I was listening to a James Altucher podcast just a little bit ago, and he was being asked all these questions by Farnoosh Torabi. She was on CNBC and some other things. She asked him about that exact question, and his response was, I CC my kids on all of my major business dealings because I want them to see the decisions that I make and how it goes down. And if I die, they get all my money. They can have all of my money, and they will either do well with it or they will not. But he thinks that the motivation is innate within the person. Whether you're motivated or not is up to you. And you're either going to make money with money or you're going to lose it all. And that's innate to you. And I'll draw a parallel back to the economic thing and say it this way. there are plenty of people who are billionaires and they continue to work. They don't quit working because they're billionaires. They just want to achieve more. And there are also plenty of people who are homeless and they aren't working their ass off to become not homeless. So it would seem to support that at least on the extreme cases, you have people where money is not a motivator, right? Billions of dollars, what's it matter if you have another $1 billion? It's not going to change your lifestyle. The money isn't the actual motivator. There's some other intrinsic motivator there. And on the flip side, you're homeless, man. You need some money. And they literally couldn't care less. Will not work.
I guess here's the most clear way I can say what I want to give my kids. Experiences. I want them to see that dad's happy, mom's happy. If I die today, I've lived a good life. I wouldn't change one major decision I've made. Very happy. They know what my value. Well, I mean, she's four, so she probably doesn't understand my values, but they're very clearly articulated. I live according to them. That is the best thing we can, regardless of you giving money or me wanting to give some land or whatever it is we give. It's all external. Yeah. It's external. Yeah, it's bullshit. Agreed. It's not going to make them happy. It's not going to. We just hope we all try to do the best we can as government figures, authority figures, parents, owners, workers, managers, and hope that people make good decisions.
This is awesome because we came from money and we got to value, which money is supposed to be that, right? It's supposed to be a store of value. And if you think about it that way, it's sort of like some magic thing that you can turn into whatever it is that you value. And that's a wild idea to think
of. It's a tool of exchange to get what you want, what you value. I really like how Warren Buffett talks about things, and cost is what you pay for something, value is what you get.
But I think you and I are agreeing. I want to transfer all those values to my kids too. Where I am coming from that I think I'm really fighting against. And Zach, this goes back to your PI stuff, right? So I don't know if how do I give an intro to PI? It's basically like, I can't give it. Can you give a quick explanation?
Yeah, it's an assessment tool that helps you understand the motivating factors that drive your behaviors.
So there's a motivating factor that drives my behavior, which is that I am low when it comes to wanting authority. What's that one?
I don't know which one you're talking about. Like formality? Low need for formality?
Yes, that's it. So like structures and authority systems and things like that. I have this innate thing in me to rebel against them.
And mine's like twice as low as yours.
Right. And Zach does as well.
I'm a rogue.
Yeah. And so I think we share this value. And I believe what's driving me to say, like, I want to set my kids free, right? Like I want to instill these values, these very important values within them. But when I look at the world around us, I see a system, a formal system that was put in place to instill debt slavery from the start on the masses. And we are the masses. And until we have enough money in the bank that we are financially independent, like Dr. Krizek or like anyone who has money earning more than you need to take care of your quote-unquote basic cost of living, then you are at least not economically free, right? So you can talk about any other type of freedom that you want, but economically free you are not, because you have to take on debt in order to continue to live in the way that you want to.
I mean, again, we can go down so many rabbit holes. You said freedom can be money in a bank. That's obviously on the assumption that the banks are around, you know, mm-hmm. And then we have military. We could bring absolutely the idea that we have to have the military to protect our socioeconomic platform, because we all just say money in the bank. That's a huge assumption that the banks are here and will always be here.
And I took it down to economic freedom at the end.
Fair enough. So what all of this... None of this matters if our kids just all of a sudden become Buddhist, because all of this is bullshit. It's all fake stuff that created. Buddhist 101, life is suffering. We've mentioned this. All that means is we create desires every day, big ones and little ones, and we don't get most of those. And that's suffering. Being dissatisfied is suffering. So where does that come from? Our attachment to delusions, whether that's achievement, hitting a number in a bank account, driving a Ferrari, having fancy collaborative office space. It's all delusions, because the casket question at the end of the day, when you're dying, whether you're religious or not, is none of that matters.
Yeah, none of that matters. You can't take any of it with you.
So the only way to overcome that, right, the Buddhists talk about enlightenment or nirvana, is to detach yourself from the delusions.
And I love that idea.
And all of this is completely counter to everything we're talking about with money.
I know, it's right? nuts.
But it's smart, because every successful entrepreneur says, if you focus on making money, you're not going to make it. You've got, money is an outcome of something else.
This goes back to, I don't know if we included it as a change challenge, but I mentioned how if you ever get anxiety about money, you know, go live in a studio apartment.
Yeah, and you did.
Have only the basic stuff. That is our equivalent, right, in the U.S. of quote unquote suffering. You know? And so go live that life of suffering. And once you're able to handle that, you'll detach yourself from those quote unquote delusions, right? And you'll realize, I don't need this big house. I don't need that fancy car. And I'm just as happy now as, or happier, because I don't have those responsibilities, those things weighing me down.
Let me ask you something, and I don't know this. Let's say your business just takes off like crazy, even though it's already going very well, like just crazy. It's worth 8-9-figure business. What kind of car did you drive in high school?
A Camaro.
And before that? Your first car?
Oh, yeah, a Honda Civic. Honda Civic, 91 Honda
hatchback.
Civic wagon. Yeah.
Right?
It was, yeah.
So you're now worth liquid $25 million. What kind of car are you going to buy your kid? That's the kind of things that I think about.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they have to drive a 1986 Honda Prelude, but if I go out and buy them I don't even know what a wealthy person would buy their
Tesla.
Maybe some kind of a Tesla or a Mercedes SUV. They have no appreciation for where that comes from. So back to your all-teacher comment, my son just turned one yesterday. Happy birthday, Ben. And Claudia, my four-year-old, wanted to go with Daddy to buy him his gift, which he needed his first pair of shoes. So I try to do all these lessons for her. She's a parrot, so she can repeat them. They don't clearly don't make sense yet. But I walked through. It was $26 I spent on a couple pairs of shoes. And I broke down, based on Dad's market rates, how long Dad would have to work in order to pay for these shoes, right? And she asks questions. And so I try to do the
That's
same
great.
Thing all tutor. And I do it all the time, because if I form this habit now, it just becomes easier as she gets older.
Then we're not arguing about what we thought we were arguing about. We're not arguing about whether you give your kids money or things or not. We're arguing about, are we confident that we can instill the value into our children so that they understand the work and struggle and, you know, everything that goes into being able to achieve that on their own.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, no, I see what you're saying.
Let's give them the struggle, right. But let's also give them a safety net of some kind. Yeah. How do we do that?
Right. That's what we're talking about. That's balancing the yin and the yang.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, I will take issue with is we can't change anyone, including our kids.
Agreed.
We can't instill anything in anyone. Can you instill something in Lauren? No. Right? That's his wife. I can't instill something in Kizzy. All we can do is live our life true to our values and hope that they extract the values that we think are meaningful, not from our life, because that's past facing, but for the life that they're going to be currently living and living forward.
That's a whole other episode. That is so good, because we live our lives as if we can instill.
Value extraction. We're going to do a value extraction episode.
We live our lives as if we can instill the values that we have in other people. And we try to do it nonstop, especially for the people that I love. And I try to do it unsuccessfully over and over again.
I just sent off three potential workshop topics for an organization that wants to bring me in. And they always just think, give me the tools so I can change these people in the workplace.
Yes.
Right? And you can't, as the expert, they're looking for you to tell them how they can change others. And I want to slap them and say, you can't. You can create an environment so that they'll want to change on their own. But that takes values. And goals.
Well, I think we came to a
really, and money.
I think we came to a really good conclusion when we're talking about money and our kids, right? So we came to it on this. So now if I extract that and I take it back to what I was saying with governments and welfare, then what I would say is something similar, which is I believe that the places that have the higher taxes and the higher social safety net end up with better education systems and lower crime and all of that, because there is some sort of shared value in those societies that allows for better usage of that when it's given away. Whereas, you know, in other, so there are some, probably some other societies where you could try to provide such a safety net and it would be used frivolously and it would be unsuccessful. The argument that I always hear against a universal basic income, whenever you say, well, look at those countries, look at Northern Europe and how successful it is over there. The argument I hear against it is, yeah, but you couldn't do that in the United States for a couple of reasons. Number one, there's just too many people. Number two, we're just a different type of society. I think it comes down to, it might be values. It might just be that.
Absolutely. And again, I want to be clear, I'm not against social safety.
Oh, no.
Country level, because you're trying to paint me as some right-wing crazy person.
No, I've dropped that. I've said we've come to the same conclusion.
The one thing I will say is that homogeneity versus heterogeneity, it's very difficult for the United States to do any kind of unified social policy.
It is.
Because we have diversity. Crazy diversity.
True, crazy
they
diversity.
Are 100% homogenous over there, for the most part.
They are.
It's much easier because those values probably are shared a little more easily over there.
I agree, but I'll flip it a little.
But it makes it more fun over here.
It makes it more fun. It makes it crazier over here. I'll flip it a little bit and I'll say there are some, I will refer to some homogenous Central American societies that I have either read about or visited. Like Brazil is a perfect example of one that I've visited, and I hear their economy is coming along well, but I'll say it this way. If we're talking about it on a country basis and social safety net basis, we are basically in between Central American and South American countries with little to no social safety net and Northern European countries with a really high social safety net. We fall somewhere in the middle, and our country, you know, like they say, you can never be neutral on a moving train. You're either going one way or the other. And you've got the right-wing people who are arguing we need to go more the way of Central American countries where there's less social safety net. You've got left-wing people generally arguing we need to go more the Northern European way. They won't ever admit it, but that's what they're arguing. So I've experienced that Central American way. And they're a homogenous society, but with no social safety net, they end up with very few very rich people, a ton of very poor people, like shanty towns where you've got plywood and people living in these, you know, four-story plywood shacks. You can't, like, walk down the street. When we were walking down the street, they told our group, the women in our group, hold your purse away from the road because people riding by on motorcycles will rip the purse off of your shoulder because everybody's poor. Crime is everywhere. When you're driving down the highway, you would see people camping in the median. And so what I would say is, if we're talking about this from a macro sense for our country, which way do you want to go? Do you want to have to have a 10-foot wall around your house with razor wire because you're the one wealthy person and there's so many poor people around you, and that's what, and there's crazy crime because of it, and you have to send your kids to private schools and have bodyguards because they'll get kidnapped, which is what happens in these countries? Or do you want to pay more taxes, way more taxes, and have way better education for the masses, way better health care for the masses, and end up looking more like one of those Northern European countries? I think that that's a valid conversation that we need to have in this country.
Yeah, I do too. I appreciate the tension. The logical end of either one of those extremes is not good.
Yeah, you're right.
So having the tension, having only a two-party political system, which I used to be completely against, I don't know. My thinking has evolved a bit on that because it incrementally goes back and forth in political ping pongs. Again, I don't have enough information to make an informed conclusion or decision on that. I don't study global economies and that sort of thing.
No, to be honest, really.
It just, I don't care. It doesn't interest me. It doesn't resonate with me. What resonates with me has always been the micro, and it will always be the micro. How do I raise my household? What can I do for my business or my income, my community? will always be more important. I guess where the macro comes in is I've been able to grow up in a society that has allowed me to do that and think about that. So if it was the South American society that Dave's describing, I'd be thinking about just surviving and wouldn't have the opportunity to think this way. So I appreciate that. Mm. But then, like I said, then that comes in the military argument and all of that.
Right. So you said something that I thought was very interesting. We talked about how if, you know, we kind of agree that we want to give our kids opportunity, freedom, you know, we don't want them to be in debt.
Experience.
We want them to have the struggle, but also have the
opportunity. I think you used the right word, opportunity.
Okay, the opportunity. You talked about an exercise you did with Claudia where you purchased shoes for her and you told her, you know, I have to work this long at market rate to get these shoes and stuff.
I mean, those aren't the words I use, but yes, that's what I did.
How did that go? Did you see her like?
Her wheels are spinning. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm like, well, what are you thinking? Well, where did the shoes come from? Right. And she just starts asking questions. So I threw out sort of the general topic. Dad had to work X long to buy these shoes for Ben. What do you mean? Well, do you see this little card? This is money. Right. And start trying to explain what a credit card is. All right. Well, where did these shoes come from? Well, let's look. I said, do you think they were made in Missouri? No. In the United States? I don't know. Oh, nope, made in China, right? And so then I start talking about what that means, who made these shoes, how they got shipped to the United States, that sort of thing.
I love it because that's like, there's advanced stuff. I think it was international business or one of my economics classes where we had to learn the calculation of why global trade allows for more goods and services than if you didn't have global trade. And we had to
show. If it was all local.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're like planting those seeds in Claudia's head when she's this young.
It's now, don't get me wrong. I don't have some elaborate plan, right? I just truly believe in learning and growth and knowledge. And the more you know, the more you can do with that. And so these are just some seeds that, you know, maybe I didn't get planted when I was younger. And they kind of have to listen to me. They're my kids, you know?
One thing that we talked about that I think is important is successful people and the support that they have from their parents and their upbringing.
Or whoever raised them.
And what kind of an advantage that gives them.
Yeah.
So I can't remember what the example was, but I brought up the fact that Zach and I, when we were 12, 14.
We were in high school, yeah. So
15, 16?
I was 14, you were 15.
We decided that we were going to become rich with a multi-level marketing.
Network marketing. Multi-level marketing. Pyramid schemes to many haters.
Yep. And
Excel.
And so we went to our parents. We said, hey, guys, we need you to be our backers, our investors. You know, we're going to make so much money off of this thing. Who wouldn't want to switch their long-distance provider? Everyone's going to want to do this. They're going to see that they're going to save 0.7 cents per hour on long-distance calling.
Oh, man.
Man, we'll get everybody. You're going to change the world. So we decided that we wanted to do this. We, you know, got the buy-in. We went to a bunch of meetings.
Went to friends' homes, but persuaded their parents to switch.
Right.
We actually got people to switch.
Well, no, we had mild success with it. The reason I bring this up is because we basically had a universal reaction from everyone, from our parents to our social circle, which was, you're wasting your money.
Right.
You're throwing away your money. And we talked about how, you know, that actually, and I don't want to give blame or anything, but that did have an impact on our thinking about what we were doing and our follow through with
it.
And we talked about how we would, you know, I don't know if it would be through a multi-level marketing scheme, you know, necessarily, but if our kids came to us saying, we want to do this, we want to start a business, we want to make money, whatever. If it was a poor business idea, we would probably give an alternative. We wouldn't say you're wasting your money, you're throwing away money. At the very least, we would say, I love the initiative that you're trying to take.
Right. What's the plan? What's the goal? How are we going to execute?
Show it. Yeah, we would start critiquing their business plan and how, you know, that in itself would give our kids a huge advantage, we think,
but
at least.
But again, potentially. That's what we hope. But the flip side, if our parents were rich, if we grew up in Ladue, which just got ranked in the top 10 most affluent cities in the United States based on, I think it was 30,000 cities. It's number 8 in the entire United States. Yeah. So it's affluent. When I say if we grew up in Ladue, per capita income, per person, not household, is $98,000 a year in Ladue. Nice. So if our parents lived there, we would have grew up affluent.
Yeah.
I don't think that the reaction may have been any different. It could have been the same, you idiots, because it's a multi-level marketing business, potentially. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, but I think there's a greater likelihood that they would say, that's the wrong business model.
Okay, fair
Let
enough.
Me show you fair a better enough. Alternative.
Fair enough. One thing we've been touching on tangentially without calling it is the idea of financial literacy. And that is something that's always been interesting to me. One of my senior projects as an undergrad was putting together a large financial literacy project. I forget what class it was for, but I was very proud of what I threw together, collected a lot of primary data and research, and submitted it to some local organization here in St. Louis, and I'm sure they put it in a drawer. But what I've thought about lately is that usually that term is for people, for young kids, for people in high school, and that's about it. And I think that's a wrong approach. I think financial literacy should never end, and for one reason, cryptocurrency. And then there will be something after cryptocurrency. New financial models and vehicles are never going to stop in our current society, right? In our institutional structures. So you have to think about financial literacy your entire life.
Oh, man. I would say some controversial things on this almost. Number one, I think that kids should be learning it from the start. I love what you did with Claudia, because that is a part of financial literacy. Whether or not you're talking about what part of the financial system, that is a very important basis of it. I think people need to understand what our system is. That's a huge hole. Most people don't really understand. You hand someone a dollar, and they see that it's a dollar. They understand what it is. I can trade this in for a pack of gum or whatever. They don't understand where that dollar came from. They don't understand something that's called the fractional reserve banking system. That should be taught to everyone. And I'm talking about, here we are at the Center for Emerging Technologies, right? So we've got some—
our office space.
That's where we're recording this right now. We've got some very, very smart people walking around us. Right now I'm looking at an office that has a danger laser light across the way from us.
We've got a genomics office right here.
Yeah, we've got basically biotechnology folks surrounding us. I would venture to say some of them wouldn't be able to answer the question, how does our fractional reserve banking system work? They probably wouldn't be able to, you know? And that is, it's crazy. If you get the chance, go Google it. But I'll give a really brief synopsis of it now, because it's kind of blows your mind. Number one, the Federal Reserve is a privately owned entity is owned by a group of families. Everyone thinks it's a government entity. It's not.
Quasi-governmental.
Whenever our government wants to print a dollar, they have to call up the Fed and say, "Dear Fed, we would like to print a dollar." And the Fed says, "Okay, we will issue a bond, right? Or something. We will buy a bond from you. We will issue you a loan. We will buy a bond from you. You can go ahead and print that dollar, but the instant that you print that dollar, you owe us back that dollar plus interest." So think about it in a term. Then the Fed or the government goes and prints $1. The next day, if they need to go pay the Fed back, there isn't even enough money in existence to do so, because they owe them that dollar plus interest. This ensures two things. Number one, it ensures debt, because the day one, there is debt. Someone owes a dollar plus more. And it ensures an expanding money supply. So it ensures inflation. So if you were just going to say, "I'm just going to save my money and be a money hog," that money will be worth less tomorrow than it was today. If you don't understand those two basic principles, then you don't understand. You can't even start talking about real financial literacy. So debt is implied. Somebody is always in debt. If you have debt, you are losing money by not spending money. You don't need to spend any more money. You have money going out the door just by the fact that you have debt. Even if you have no debt, you're perfectly at zero, the amount of money that you have is shrinking over time. Everyone needs to know that because of inflation. Not many people really fully understand that. And on the flip side, once you reach critical mass, think of money like a magnet that attracts other money. Once you have a big enough nugget of money, it will attract so much money that you don't need to go out and work and earn any more money, because it's like you have an invisible person working for you.
And you pay less taxes because of that.
And our whole system is set up to reward the people who have
that.
It's
so funny. People that don't realize that the people that write our laws and find the loopholes in our laws are...
Yeah, you'll get taxed way more if you go work to earn your money than if you have it a big hunk of money that's being a money magnet. You'll get taxed way less. Yes,
that is absolutely great.
I think those principles are some of the first things that I want to teach my kids. Because when you get out there, the common, I'll say this, financial literacy common sense is all a load of BS, if you ask me. Because what is it? You use credit cards to get to, and we have these interests, and there's good debt and there's bad debt. If you buy a house and you get into debt, that's good debt. You know what I mean? It's like...
It's interesting because I literally have... Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, pulled up on my computer. And one of the things I was looking for is if his company, which is called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, had a product, a game that you could play with toddlers, with young 4 or 5 year olds, to begin teaching these things. And they don't. The first game they have, it says, is for, you know, 14 year olds. So, of course, I'll try to start my kids on it when they're like 8.
Yeah, of course.
But to me, it's just... You've got to think through these terms, whether it's at the macro level, the fractional reserve banking, which is how the structural system, the infrastructure of our financial system works, or at the micro level, which is where I prefer, of how your personal finances work. Either way, it's important. It's very important.
And you're not going to be taught that. You're going to be taught all these things that are actually destructive. Financially destructive. Like, it's okay to take loans. Debt is okay. Debt is normal.
Well, the financial industry is great at coming up with excellent marketing headlines for stuff. For instance, it's not a second mortgage anymore. It's a home equity loan.
A home equity loan. So I would just challenge everyone to go think about those financial principles that I just stated at the very end here. Do a little bit of reading about it, and then be uber critical when you see financial marketing. When you see, take a loan on this car for 72 months. You know, it's totally a good idea. The car is going to go down in value, and 6 years from now, you're still paying it off. It's amazing to me what quote-unquote people think financial literacy even means.
Well, do we want to throw out some change challenges? Because I think we might be getting kicked out of this room soon.
Yeah, let's do one. You have an idea for one?
I do, but if you've got one, you can
go
ahead.
I don't.
So my first one would be find a money mentor, right? It can be formal, like having a CPA, an accountant, a CFP, certified financial planner. You know, we're both lucky enough to have a very close friend also be our CFP. And so we can trust him with the decisions that he makes on our behalf, because I trust my children with him and he does vice versa. So find an advisor, find a money mentor, and you might have to find different people. And they don't have to have credentials. Just find people that you admire or respect that might be good at saving money and pick their brain. Somebody that might be good at on the investing side of money. And then maybe somebody's really good at running a tight household or family situations with money. And just start picking their brain and trying to learn something from them and implement one thing.
I like that change challenge. I've got one that is going to be called Follow the Money.
Ooh, Art Ponder.
The next time that you read something that is a controversial political topic, it could be about the environment, it could be a law about the environment, a law about taxes and social welfare or safety nets, do your best to try to come up with a list of who are the winners if this goes through and who are the losers if this goes through. Follow the money, because when you follow the money, you'll understand the true intention of what the law is, right? So we'll give one that's just a really clear one, right? So you have these environmental laws that get repealed, right? So you have an environmental law in place that's meant to protect the earth. It's almost unbelievable that we would question, well, why would you want to protect the earth? I mean, It's just the thing that we're living on, and our kids are going to have to inherit and everything, right? So a law is going to be repealed. The reason that will be given for it will be it's going to create jobs. It's going to help the middle class. It's going to, right? So, and people will buy into that. But if you play the follow the money game and you look at who, what companies were the biggest lobbyists for this law and what, who was going to benefit the most from this law being overturned, repealed.
Whose bank account is going to benefit the most.
That's right. Then you're going to find out, okay, I see the interest behind this. I see the motivation behind it. And that allows you to have a much better understanding of whether you support it or not. You may. I'm not saying you don't, that you have to, you know, oppose it. Maybe you will support it. But you will see through that veneer, that lie, that, oh, it's going to create jobs. It's going to help the middle class, which you hear so much.
I will say this, that following the money, if you make that part of your mental philosophy, you will become cynical. But point blank.
That's it.
That's a fact.
It's tough. You will
become cynical. You will not be able to live under the veil that ignorance is bliss anymore. And that's a choice, and it's not a fun one.
It's a take the blue pill or the red pill.
That's 100%. So right. If you prefer not thinking through that and not having the truth, what did they say in the movie The Big Short? The truth is like poetry, and most people fucking hate poetry.
I love it. I love it. What a way. That's the best way that we can end this show.
Amen.
All right.
Great. Well, thanks. And like we always say,
experiment with life.